On This Week in Enterprise Tech, there's new AI, a new scam, inept hackers, and an electric grid that is falling apart. All that before our guest who's talking about hybrid storage, Quiet on the Set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 278, recorded February 16, 2018. Why enterprises still tiptoe around the cloud.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. Learn more at g.co/getgke today. And by IT Pro TV, the fun and entertaining way to sharpen your IT skills. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription.
Hey, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, your guide to the latest, greatest, best, and brightest in enterprise technology every week. I'm Kurt Franklin, your host for this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we have an outstanding show in store for you. We're going to be talking about storage, but not just your plain, ordinary storage. No, we're going to throw a little bit of everything into the pot and see what kind of tasty storage we can dish up. Before we get there, though, we've got news, we've got excitement, and I've got one of my Twyatt colleagues to help me out, Brian Chi, director of the Advanced Network Computing Lab at the University of Hawaii. Brian, how are things out there in paradise?
Well, the storm has passed. We're not getting cats and dogs raining upon us. The streets have drained. Life is good. The sun is out. And supposedly, I'm going to be bobbing around on an old World War II landing craft off Kaneohe Bay Marine Corps Air Base, terminating fiber optics for a wave power buoy later this afternoon.
I tell you, you just know how to have all the fun. Well, before we let you go out there and bob around on the waves, let's get to some blips. There's a new kid on the AI chip block. Its name is Amazon. According to website The Information, Amazon has been acquiring and hiring specialists in chip making for a couple of years. At the same time, the e-commerce giant has been developing its own artificial intelligence processor for its Alexa-powered hardware. Now, it just makes sense that speeding up responses to voice commands could prove crucial in the coming years as the race to rule the roost grows more difficult. AI-powered assistants from the likes of Google, Apple, Samsung, and Microsoft are also in the running, and the speed of response might influence consumers' decision in choosing which hardware brand's ecosystem of products and services to invest in. It's worth noting that Amazon's approach differs from what others have been working on their chips. Google and Huawei, for example, have been using their specialized processors to improve camera performance on their flagship phones, while Apple's A11 Bionic processor enables features like Face ID, which uses, again, that depth camera for facial recognition.
Well, folks, while T-Mobile has been sending out waves of text messages to all their customers warning about what's called a port-out scan, this is something that can actually work on other carriers as well. So let's dive into it. Phone number port-out scam is an obscure term, but it refers to a relatively simple, highly effective, and dangerous hack. The scammer calls T-Mobile or any other cell phone provider or goes to a store and impersonates the target victim, requesting a new SIM card for the victim's phone number. The same process also works by porting the phone number to another provider, giving the hacker access to the victim's phone number. The gist is that scammers are porting your cell phone to other carriers to steal your mobile number and use that as a springboard to take over your personal accounts. Since so many customers now use SMS as two-factor authentication, taking over your mobile number means hackers can potentially authenticate their way into your bank accounts and social media. The easiest way to combat this is to dial 611 for customer service on your mobile and tell the support staffer that you want to create a port validation passcode. What this also means is you'll be prompted for this passcode every time you want to make a change to your mobile account, so don't lose it. The instructions in the article from Motherboard is for T-Mobile, but something similar, unfortunately, also works on other carriers.
What's worse than a hacker? A hacker who can't control their malware. Analysts at Alien Vault published details on multiple attacks after collecting evidence from the millions of malicious files they scan every day. All of these attacks are separate but share commonalities, including a link to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and causing more harm than was likely intended. The malware that went rogue includes Rivets, a malware family created in 2009, JML, which started on Visual C++ 5.0 and MASM 6.0 and was reportedly created in 1997 as part of a student's university project and later became a North Korean military standard, and FedEver, most likely an intentional compromise by an outside attacker. Now, it's important to note that there are some runaway malware variants that have little to nothing to do with North Korea. For example, WannaCry, the attack that was created by Lazarus Group and spread via SMB file shares, shares some of the same code base as the Bramble malware variant, which was also released by Lazarus Group over the years. The difference is that WannaCry is another instance in which the attacker lost control. Seems strange to say that malware authors really need to up their game, but the unintended consequences are getting worse than their intended damage.
You know, what happened to all the magic competition promised by the telecom industry? So, the latest Internet Access Services report was released by the Federal Communications Commission last week. The report's broadband competition chart shows that 44% of developed census blocks had zero home broadband providers offering download speeds of at least 100 megabits per second and upload speeds of at least 10 megabits per second. 41% of developed census blocks had one ISP offering such speeds, for a total of 85% with zero or one ISP. The remaining 15% had two or three providers at that level as of the end of 2016. That's a bit up from June 30th, 2016, when about 12% of the census blocks had at least two providers of 100 megabits per second services. So while this data is at least a year old, it does muddy the water on the argument that killing net neutrality would encourage competition. So I guess that we'll have to see what next year's report has to say once the ISPs have had a year of net neutrality not being there to create drag on deployments.
Smart IoT has been accused of a lot, but one thing it's going to do is change the way regulations are enforced for business. Disruption isn't a term regulators comfortably use, and a world of fast-changing policies is not a future most corporations want to embrace. But that's precisely what's coming, and both businesses and governments had best be ready. Civic analytics, harnessing data analytics capabilities to improve government service, is not wholly new. I mean, smart tax systems have been improving tax compliance and collections for some time. Analytics are helping to police financial crimes such as money laundering and tax fraud, and other government systems use civic analytics for welfare and employment, public security, transportation, and economic development. But those are just first steps. Government data initiatives are fueling a movement toward evidence-based policymaking, according to a McKinsey report. Unfortunately, reality isn't nearly as logical and organized as it may sound. For example, it may not be clear which agency has jurisdiction in every case, regardless of what the data shows. In this scenario, turf protection could be a huge problem. In the end, though, it's likely that smaller government budgets and bulging populations will bring an end to any resistance to change. voters aren't likely to accept the alternative, which would be drastic cuts in government services. Like all disruptors, smart cities will change everything, despite the objections of former giants and power brokers.
You know, we do a predictions episode every year, and our 2018 predictions don't seem like they're that far off anymore when it comes to voice interfaces. Increasingly sophisticated voice assistants and the growing potential use cases they can assist in are driving customers to adopt them in greater droves. 65% of U.S. smartphone owners are employing voice assistants in 2015, up significantly from 30% just 2 years prior. Consumers are also eagerly adopting speaker-based voice assistants, with shipments of Google Home and Amazon Echo speakers expected to climb more than threefold to 24.5 million in 2017, according to a report from Voice Labs. So while we agree that open offices are certainly a roadblock to voice interfaces, this report from Voice Labs seems to indicate that consumers are at least actually using voice interfaces in growing numbers. The voice assistant landscape is divided between smartphone and speaker-based assistants. These distinctions, while important now, will lose relevance in the long run, as more assistants can be used in both kinds of devices. The primary players in the space are Apple's Siri, Microsoft's Cortana, Google Assistant, Amazon Alexa, and Samsung's Vive.
There's a new global cybersecurity initiative, and it's being led by Siemens. A new charter of trust aims to make security a key element of critical infrastructure, one of the foundations of the digital economy. ICS, SCADA giant Siemens, along with IBM, Airbus, Allianz, Daimler, NXP, SGS, T-Mobile, and the Munich Security Conference today outlined a new global effort aimed at making cybersecurity a major component and philosophy for business and governments. The so-called Charter of Trust centers around the basic goals of protecting the data of individuals and businesses, preventing harm to critical infrastructure, businesses, and individuals via cyber attacks, and establishing a reliable and trusted network infrastructure. Now, there are 10 principles of security in the charter, and you can read about those at the link. But how will the charter roll out? The group wants to promote the initiative through various channels to companies, both large and small, to have them sign up. In parallel, they'll be presenting this to various governments to demonstrate that industry is taking cybersecurity seriously, acting in a proactive way to address the threats without the need for additional regulation, and also as a way to help shape cybersecurity policies. Well, that's the blips. We've got more news and a great guest to come. But before we move on, well, it just wouldn't be quiet if we didn't hear from Padre.
Thanks, guys. We'll get right back to the action. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And I'm really excited about this one because this is a true enterprise product for Enterprise Geek. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by the Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. When you're building an application, you need it to be fast, secure, and always evolving. With the Kubernetes Engine, developers can easily deploy containerized apps on a fully managed service from Google Cloud Platform. Google has been running production workloads in containers for more than 10 years, and they build the best of what they learn into the Kubernetes Engine. The Kubernetes Engine combines automatic scaling, updates, and reliable self-healing infrastructure with open-source flexibility to cut down on your development cycles and move from idea to production quickly and reliably. The Kubernetes Engine handles scheduling deployments for your workloads to maximize resource optimization so that you can focus on your apps, the things that you actually develop, not the things that you need for your tools. Auto-scaling allows you to handle increased demand of your services and will scale back down in the quiet periods to save you money. Google is the only hyperscale cloud provider to offer an SLA for clusters running on Kubernetes. It's also backed by experts on Google's security and reliability engineering team and is both HIPAA and PCI compliant. Now, worried about getting locked in? Don't. With the Kubernetes Engine, you're free to take your workloads out and run them anywhere Kubernetes is supported. You can learn more about the Kubernetes Engine at g.co slash GETGKE today. That's g.co/getGKE. One more time, g.co/getGKE. And we thank the Kubernetes Engine by the Google Cloud Platform for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get back to the action.
Thanks, Padre. And we are back to the action. And, well, we've got something fairly scary to talk about because hackers are attacking the electrical grid. Now, last September, news broke that hackers had laid siege to the U.S. power grid, probing deep into dozens of energy firms looking for weaknesses to exploit. The Department of Homeland Security issued a threat warning about an ongoing stream of malware attacks that could one day lead to what's called a black sky event, crippling cell phones, erasing bank accounts, devastating hospitals, and disrupting every sector of the economy. Girding our grid, some of which dates back to 1917, could cost $500 billion, that's with a B, dollars. Too pricey for the more than 3,200 private companies that own the hardware of the grid. Now, the grid's enemies rely on expert hackers to carry out their attacks. Most of the utilities they target lack that same level of expertise, defending themselves with pencil pushers rather than professionals. That's because, well, there just aren't enough tech-savvy hired guns to go around. To combat this vulnerability, a federal task force is setting up mutual assistance pacts, allowing one team of cyber saviors to help multiple companies. Now, this would be similar to the kind of mutual assistance pacts that lead multiple companies to send fleets of bucket trucks when something like a hurricane or a huge winter storm hits an area. A hacker's ultimate goal is to own a master control center. Within these critical hubs, system operators rely on video-covered walls and button-filled consoles to keep the grid going. If a malignant program breaks through, it could corrupt the data that controllers rely on. So some power companies are creating duplicates. These twin nerve centers trade off grid control duties and can also access pre-hack backups, allowing workers to replace a virus-infected system with a clean version. An article in Popular Science goes on to say that when a huge power outage occurs, operations have 3 days to get things back up and running before food spoils, medicine and water runs out, batteries die, and the public, well, loses what little marbles they seem to have. Speedy fixes are vital, but that's difficult when the grid plugs thousands of power plants and even more customers into the same rather rickety infrastructures. Companies like PJM Interconnection, which serves 13 eastern states, administer organized market. They help utilities obtain power from one another, which makes it easier to restore the grid. But let's remember, those switching and control centers have to be operational to take advantage of the power that's available. Now, Chibert, I want to bring you in on this because I know that you spend a lot of time working with things like smart grid applications and research projects. From where you're sitting, how big a problem is this? Is this one of those things that is like Y2K turned out to be, a lot of noise about nothing much, or is this something we really should be worrying about?
Now, it's definitely a worrisome problem. So in Hawaii, we have a double-edged sword going. We can't connect to other states. You know, it's a little tough, 2,400 miles of water. So we can't buy power from the national power grid. So our power plants are isolated. In fact, Hawaiian Electric actually runs fiber optics with their high-tension wires to interconnect, have private fiber to interconnect power plants and switching stations and things like that. Not so much when you start dealing with larger continents like North America, South America, Europe, Asia, and so forth. You have to have interconnection. The days of having your power grid completely air-gapped is gone. We can't afford it anymore. We have to be able to buy power from cheaper sources. You know, maybe go up north into Canada to go get a lot of really inexpensive hydroelectric, or maybe if you're in eastern United States, maybe the Niagara power plant and things like that. So what happens is more and more of the smaller companies sadly have to use public infrastructure. You know, they might be lease lines, or they might actually, in some cases for smaller substations, actually use public internet. And you know, then they go and do the VPN game. There's a lot of problems with all of this, and coordinating lots and lots and lots of moving pieces is really tough, especially when you start having to have something that's inexpensive. So like, for instance, if you wanted to have a remote switch that might be way the heck out in the boonies, you don't want to have to dispatch a bucket truck for someone to go and flip a switch. It might take hours to get there, especially if traffic's horrible or weather or whatever. So you start ending up using cellular. We all know that cellular isn't perfect. Just look at what happened to the Jeep Cherokee that got driven off the road after a hack. So there are some issues. The power companies are going up a very, very steep hill. And now as we start putting in more and more sustainables, those smart switches, smart inverters, have to be told to be able to crank back if we're going to overwhelm the power grid. So what we're having is lots and lots and lots of moving parts, lots and lots and lots of interconnections, and lots of places that could potentially be a problem. But what we don't have lots and lots of are we don't have a lot of cyber specialists. So JJ, you're in the chat room. We need more of you guys to help defend our national power grid. What say you, JJ? Kurt?
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in talking about, as you point out, we've got this real mishmash of technology, both from a control standpoint and even from a generation and transmission standpoint. We've got some very new state-of-the-art hardware out there. And we've got some stuff that pretty much has Edison's signature on the approval sheet. So my question is, this mishmash, from a security standpoint, is it an advantage or a disadvantage? Does it make the hacker's job easier or harder that there's not one unified grid that we're talking about?
It certainly means you got to have more talent and more depth so you can learn how, so you know how to work all these different pieces. Some of these devices, let's just call them devices, are, like you said, pretty old. I swear Edison era. Some of the first net, a lot of these SCADA devices are old enough that they didn't have internets then. They didn't have even intranets. There's basically serial. And then what manufacturers have done is they slapped on things. So let's use Modbus as an example. There's an awful lot of Modbus devices out there. And trust me, you ping them too hard and they will crash, at least some of the early ones. So some of the new stuff, like what BAE Power Systems is developing, is they're trying to go and say, hey, these old devices, these old Modbus devices and their ilk are past their prime. So as you start, upgrading, let's upgrade to something new. Don't cheap out. Let's go and get something that's actually designed to be on a network and also designed to have enough facilities to defend themselves against attacks. Tipping something over with just a continuous ping is no bueno. But having something that's, too expensive, also not bad. So, Kurt, you're going to say something?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and it makes absolutely perfect sense. I can see the business problem being that what we're asking the utilities to do is spend an incredible amount of money, as we said in the prologue to this, up to $500 billion for something that doesn't involve new revenue opportunities. I mean, I know some of these companies, they would be thrilled to spend $500 million if it meant that they could get new customers or charge more money for a new service or even raise their rates. But I think they're going to have a real problem going to the public service commissions that are out there and saying, we need to have a big rate increase just so we can do the kind of maintenance that we should have been doing to keep our system from toppling over. Are you seeing anything from your interaction with the utilities that says that they're scared enough that they're willing to actually invest in this rather than trying to do only what they can pass along the cost for?
Yeah, obviously it's a balancing act. I was actually privy to a meeting that, was scary and also heartwarming at the same time. There's an awful lot of effort being put in. So you know those old movies where you have the two man, you know, in a Minuteman missile silo, and they both have to turn the key at the same time. The power industry seems to be taking that to heart. They're saying, okay, we can't afford to blow millions or billions of dollars on upgrades, but we might be able to afford, you know, a couple million here and there. So let's do key upgrades and then start throwing in a lot of procedures. So I actually was at this meeting, they're saying, yeah, you can make changes remotely, but you can only make changes remotely from vetted locations. And it has to, you can't make the changes unless it's confirmed by a third party. So that's kind of cool. It didn't cost a ton of money to do this, but procedurally, it was taking a lot of cues from the U.S. military, which sounds like not a bad idea. And, you know, maybe, just maybe, we're going to start seeing a lot more of this, you know, using their money smarter to go and hit the low-hanging fruit, you know, the places where you could potentially try and break in and take over a control center. Those are where they're going to hit. That's where the utilities are going to invest first and then move outwards as revenue allows.
Well, this is obviously something that we're going to be talking about a lot more because it's an ongoing story. This is not something where even if they start to fix it, it's going to be fixed quickly or easily. We've got to do that. But we really want to get to our guest. Before we can get to our guest, though, Twyatt lives because of its great sponsors and advertisers, and Padre's here to tell you about another one.
Sorry to break in one more time, but I do want to take just a little bit of time to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we get asked a lot, how do we get into IT? Oh, now, my gang here, we kind of got in the old way, which is we had an interest. Maybe we signed on as an apprentice somewhere. We just found knowledge. We surrounded ourselves with the people who understood the industry, and that was a great learning experience. But that doesn't work for everyone. Some people need a different kind of learning experience to get into the IT game, and that's why we're happy to have IT Pro TV as a sponsor of the Twyatt Riot. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV, which lets you sharpen your IT skills and empower your team. IT Pro TV offers over 3,300 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training with more than 125 hours added each week. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on-demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or by using their iOS or Android apps. Basically, any way you want. There's no need to go off-site for training. IT Pro TV does IT Live every day, so you know you're getting the most current IT training. The courses include CEH version 9, CISA, SQL Server 2016, Azure 7533, CCNA Security, CompTIA Plus, and so much more. You can track your team's results and prove the ROI of your training spend with IT Pro TV's Supervisor Portal. It gives you full control of your team's training schedule. You can create custom groups and training assignments. You can view logins, viewing time, video downloads, and course completion tracking. You can even see individual and group analytics. Go ahead and check out their team solution for group pricing. Now, we love when people love IT Pro TV. If you're looking for that next step, if you're looking to get into IT, or if you just need a reference for knowledge that you might have forgotten, well, IT Pro TV is for you. Now, if you're interested in learning more about IT Pro TV's team solutions, contact them for a free trial, including their supervisor portal, itpro.tv/enterprise, or sign up for an individual monthly membership and a free 7-day trial at itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30. You'll receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. No, and you can join the more than 90,000 IT Pro TV members today. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Transcender practice exams and virtual labs, are normally $857 a year. But you only pay $600 when you go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI, that's proven. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get back to Twyatt.
Thanks, Padre. Well, It's hard to find a part of the computing infrastructure that has a bigger impact on functionality and performance than storage. Now, that's true whether you're talking about on-premise stuff or applications in the cloud. So today we're going to be talking with Clear Sky Data, a company that looks at that storage issue, both on-prem and in the cloud, and figures out a way to bring some rationality to the whole thing. They've got some interesting technology that we're going to be spending a lot of time talking about, and some fascinating use cases. Now, here to talk to us about that is Laz Vekiorides, who is CTO and co-founder of Clear Sky. Laz has been active in the industry for more than 20 years, serving in key technical and leadership roles, delivering breakthrough technologies. He was executive director of software engineering for Dell's Aqualogic Storage Engineering Group. And he also was at the core leadership team of Aqualogic. Before that, he was in a bunch of companies, including 3Com and Banyan Systems. So Laz knows about both the networking side of things and the storage. He's a blogger. We're going to ask him about where to find his information. He's a frequent speaker, and he's got degrees from, well, some fairly high-end places, including Northeastern and Worcester Poly. Now, when you look at the storage market, it is fragmented. We've got on-premise, we've got cloud, we've got hybrid. And Laz, want to bring you in, say hello, and start talking about just how we're going to bring some degree of rationality to the whole thing. Laz, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
So, you mentioned I think you were alluding to the fact that there are so many silos of data storage and data management, and what the world really needs is sort of a single normalized view of data, and I think that's just one of the things that we sought to deliver at Clear Sky Data. That's our fundamental product is a way to bring that rationality across the spectrum of all the locations that you access your data.
So, here's the question. Why is it so hard to bring that rationality in? Is it primarily a hardware issue, or does it get back to the software that we're using to decide where the different data bits are stored?
It's a software issue. You mentioned earlier that that the industry is very fragmented, and what's really interesting about the industry is that it maintains that fragmentation almost indefinitely. And when companies buy data storage infrastructure, they buy it in sort of application specific silos, and so. That the problem then becomes, well, what happens when you want to move these applications around? But in general, every customer that we've talked to over the last 4 years has some ridiculous number of enterprise storage silos, and so it's driven by software, it's driven by use cases, performance requirements. Protection requirements, different SLAs to different business units. So every single application tends to end up becoming a snowflake. And then you have the cloud. The interesting thing about the cloud is that anything that runs in the cloud kind of has the same SLA because you only have one offering out there. So in many ways, it's sort of the other guardrail. You can have any storage you like as long as it's whatever your cloud vendor provides. And so hence we have the alphabet soup that you see.
Well, when you're talking about cloud storage, it seems to me that far too often what we see is a system where if a company has an application that's cloud-based, they will use storage from that same cloud vendor because they feel like, well, within the cloud, the application and the storage for the data are probably in the same data center. Are we still at a point where there is so much latency built in that you kind of have to have the application and the storage in the same place? Or are there solutions that let you genuinely move data among different locations and still get reasonable performance from most applications?
Well, so we are just that solution. And, you know, that was sort of one of the founding premises of Clear Sky Data was, to basically provide what we, in the early days, we used to call it Akamai for primary storage. And that's really what we sought to create was an environment where location is independent. Specifically, location of compute is independent of location of data. Your data can sort of be visible and be interactively accessed across multiple locations. As a concept, there's a lot of discussion over the years around data gravity, where if you have an application like you alluded to in the cloud, it's going to stay in the cloud because the data for that application has sort of inertia. It's very difficult to move data around. What we always say is, that's not really necessarily true. I think you can build systems that through clever caching and through clever infrastructure management can do things across clouds or across locations. As an enterprise user, it's very frequent that you now start to hear, at least people that we talk to that say, we're very cautious about putting an application in this particular cloud because we may want to use some tools from the other cloud vendor, and that is not going to be possible if all the data lives in this cloud. I think we're starting to get to a point where it would be nice to be able to have these options, and we're trying to provide that option to people. You don't want to be captive to any particular range of compute tools, as the cloud providers actually evolve, it's going to be developer tools that are going to make the decision for where each application wants to be deployed. There is a way around this. To your point, latency is a problem, and latency is something that is congenital with the universe. Speed of light, you can't raise enough money to speed it up. It is what it is.
So Laz, I tell you what, we've got a YouTube video that I think makes a good introduction to what you guys do. So why don't we roll that video and you can talk about it?
Sure. Clear Sky is essentially what we're building is a network that allows customer applications that are sitting what we call on the edge, basically close to the users, to access data in the cloud as if it were local storage. What we've created essentially a fix for the latency problem. We basically built out a high-speed network and caching infrastructure in various remote locations in cities where customers live, and interconnect into the cloud. What you get in the end is access to all of your data in your local premises as if it was local. But you get all of the benefits of the cloud as well. We did it through a patented technology. We call it smart tiered caching. We have several patents around the architecture. The idea is that we separate out the hot, the warm, and the cold data, and then we identify a location where it should live based on its latency characteristics, so its latency requirements to the application. As you guys probably know, the bulk of the data out there is stone cold, and you don't want to pay to have it sitting on flash or to have it sitting on expensive durable resources. What we do is we separate out the hot, warm, cold. We created a fully managed service that essentially creates or gives you an endpoint for your storage on-prem, and then caching infrastructure that takes all of the data and moves it around inside of our network so that you get optimal performance. And you get a really substantial TCO benefit from this, because essentially you're arbitraging a small amount of high performance storage against the very, very cheap and durable storage that lives in the object storage clouds at the hyperscale providers. And so the TCO is substantial as primary storage, and you also get these other really interesting benefits. So the cloud is offsite. So if you're spending a lot of money today building secondary infrastructure in multiple sites to do offsite backups, to do DR, that sort of comes for free with this architecture.
Well, now I'm curious, and I want to be absolutely clear. You have in your solution both an on-premises component and the cloud. Is that correct? So you've got an appliance or series of appliances that you're using for storage local to the customer data center plus a cloud connection, or am I misunderstanding something important here?
Let me describe the architecture. Yes, there's a caching component, a small piece of hardware that we put in the customer's data center, and that represents the hot data for the applications that are local to that data center. And in fact, we call that the edge cache. And in fact, in any location where you have compute, you need an edge cache to actually house and manage your hot data. In our architecture. So it can be a physical device on-prem, it could be a software workload in the cloud, but in any place where you have compute that's operating on data, you need an edge cache. And everything else is in our network. We actually have a dedicated high-speed network. It's all private lines, so it's based on private Ethernet lines in metro areas, and then very, very high-speed, low latency, long haul lines to the cloud providers. And we move data back and forth. But to the customer, they just see a relatively small footprint. And it looks just like a really large, inexhaustible SAN from the software standpoint. But it's physically just, a 2U box that can scale up if needed to some pretty high capacities.
All right. Well, one of the things I want to get into is how you would adopt this. And the first one is going to be pretty basic. You talk about some of these local areas where you have your centers. Does this mean that there are only limited geographical areas where your service is available? Or is this available pretty much anywhere a customer might be located?
Today it's available in Boston, New York, the D.C. area, Dallas. We have plans to be in Chicago soon. So we're building it out. In fact, the network is going to be pretty much nationwide when we fully deploy it in the next year or two. We're very tactical in the way we deploy these sites, and it doesn't take very long for us to do it. So, within a couple of weeks, we could have a site. So that tends not to be a barrier to, acquisition for a customer. If a meaningful customer were to show up in any particular location that has good data center connectivity, we would be able to deploy pretty quickly.
All right. Well, because we're talking about networking, I want to involve my co-host, Brian Chi, because he knows as much about networking as pretty much anyone I know. Brian, what do you think? Are there some application issues that you'd like to get into regarding how ClearSky is doing what it does?
Well, I'm going to jump around just a bit and hit JJ to the 4884's question about when you store data, say it's critical data, say it's sensitive data, say HIPAA, and a lot of people say, well, we're going to have encrypted data and things like that. How are you guys handling sensitive data? How are you handling sensitive PII?
Well, one of the core tenets of our architecture is the encryption at the edge. We allow the customer to own the encryption keys physically. this is actually sort of a benefit of being on-prem. There's actually a physical box where the encryption keys actually physically reside. So the customer has their keys. They have access to those at all times. And no data anywhere in the network can be decrypted without access to those physical keys. So a customer could actually, literally pull the TPM module off of the edge controller's motherboard and be done. So this is sort of a core component. And along with that, we have a number of layers of security, bidirectional authentication. Even though we use private lines, we do encryption over those private lines. We have bidirectional authentication between all the software and hardware entities in the network. And we pay people to try and break in. That's part of the discipline that we have to go through. So we constantly have audits. In fact, we recently passed our first SOC 2 audit, which has been loads of fun if you've ever been through one of those. But this is something that we need to do in order to maintain trust of the customers that we serve.
Okay, so let's dive in. Let's go actually into the network side now. I'm assuming when you start talking about hot, warm, and cold data, we're probably talking about metro area networks. And that's probably the reason why the cities you mentioned were the low-hanging fruit. Yeah. As more and more metropolitan areas, more and more municipalities are starting to put in private networks, do you see this as an opportunity? And also, why don't we throw in net neutrality? Has net neutrality helped or hurt as you start throwing in your warm data and then the cold to the cloud? What do you say?
So that's a big tough. So it's interesting. The fiber plant in the ground right now is actually ripe for the taking in terms of where that market lives. It's actually very easy, even in the most remote locations, to find at least one or two vendors of fiber connectivity. Given where some of the businesses that we serve are, it's very hard not to have some of this fiber connectivity. And in fact, the biggest problem that we see is if you're in a building, if you're not in a well-connected data center, that you may have an issue. But we have partnerships with a lot of the local utilities, Verizon, Comcast, and so on, and they do a pretty good job of allowing us to connect to pretty much any random building. Certainly, when public infrastructure actually is available to every house, that's a wonderful thing. Because all that will do is it will serve to lower the costs. If you haven't actually priced private Ethernet and metro Ethernet, you'll be astonished at how cheap it is to get very high bandwidth connectivity. Whereas the internet, on a per unit bandwidth per dollar metric, internet connectivity is much more expensive. And you mentioned net neutrality. I've been pondering net neutrality a lot because essentially what ClearSky has built is a fast lane. I'm particularly sensitive to folks that say, no, you can't have fast lanes. But in fact, anyone can build a private network and resell it to clients like we do. And there's nothing illegal about that. It's sort of the wave of the future. And because general internet connectivity is so expensive, it's actually in many cases much cheaper to build on a network, either long haul or metro area yourself, and peer at one place and then deal with the infrastructure challenges of that rather than paying the 2x, 3x, 4x multiple to be on the general internet and then deal with the performance issues that you get.
Well, Laz, I wanted to ask, in terms of your use cases, when so many companies today have incredibly complex application infrastructures where you will have pieces of functionality that come from numerous different points, including some big providers like Salesforce or SAP or Oracle, and then bits and pieces of services that might come from elsewhere, Is that the kind of infrastructure application or application infrastructure that Clear Sky is able to work within, or is your target customer one that is doing a dedicated self-hosted kind of application that they want to spread out into the cloud? Talk to me a little bit about how your infrastructure can be used.
I think this will be the last question that I can handle because I had a hard stop at 5:30. So we're a general purpose storage platform. And so we actually will work with any type of software or system that uses block storage or file storage. So NFS, SMB, Fibre Channel, iSCSI, we handle the gamut. A lot of different types of use cases for us. Our bread and butter use cases, folks running VMware, in particular VMware and relational databases in VMware. That production test dev thing is actually a bread and butter use case for us. We have other systems where we can be an OEM. We have service provider partners that embed our storage underneath different types of solutions. For example, Splunk. Some applications like Splunk, for example, have a very, very interesting storage profile, and we solve that problem sort of automatically with our tiered caching. So it's very easy for someone to OEM us in and then solve all their storage problems. So there's that. And then we also have a set of customers. Really, they're indirect customers. They have service providers that actually need to sell block storage to their customers for various general compute purposes. And so in those cases, those customers are building applications that are very highly distributed, IoT type things where they have compute at the edge and then compute in the cloud, and they want to share that data. In those worlds, we're basically a built-in sort of a custom solution that allows them to buy their durable copy of their data once and then share that copy across multiple locations, rather than paying the cloud vendor and then paying your storage array vendor and then paying a network vendor to connect all these things together and dealing with the hassles of synchronizing copies across two locations.
All right. Well, Laz, I want to respect that hard out for you. But before you go, I know that you write, you're an occasional blogger. And if people want more information on Clear Sky, or if they just want to follow you as you write about storage, how can they do that?
ClearSkyData.com, it has a blog section. So I frequently blog there. I also editorialize a lot. So things that are not specifically related to Clear Sky. You mentioned net neutrality. I've been known to post things up on my LinkedIn profile. So you can find me on LinkedIn as well, where my blog posts get a little bit more colorful. In both places, I've posted lots of content.
Well, Laz, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest has been Laz Vekiaridis, CTO and co-founder of Clear Sky. Well, that's about another hour that you've spent with us here at This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's been a great week. We've learned a lot about storage, especially storage in a hybrid environment. Before we go, Brian, I'd love for you to talk to us about what you learned from Laz and maybe what you got from the discussion on this hybrid storage platform.
Well, the whole issue with clouds is there's a lot of inertia. And, I think, Emily Lestrange in the chat room was saying, their company does something very similar. And I agree. I think one of my goals as a producer is to try and bring in complementary or opposing opinions. And so just as a heads up, I've got a whole series of varying divisions of VMware scheduled on the show. We're going to have a whole bunch of product managers. We're going to have a couple of VPs and things like that. One of the things that a lot of people wanted is they wanted more on virtualization. I saw another comment that we want a more detail on VoIP, more detail on telecommunications. I'm actually working on that. Sadly, it's a little harder to get carriers on the show, but I'm going to keep working on that. So my Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or I'm Cheebert at twit.tv, and I'd love to hear from you. I try to go and cut and paste out of the chat room whenever I have a chance and take your ideas. I'm going to call out, how about some show titles, chat room? And, you know, Kurt, what's up with you? Other than you and I are almost ready to turn in the final draft of our book on cloud security. Our publisher is hounding us for it, and I'm doing the final consistency check now. But, you know, let's hear more from Kurt.
Yeah, it seems like we started that book back when we were digging moats and stringing barbed wire around the cloud, and we're finally going to get it in. So that's been a good process. The wonderful thing is that it's always fun when I get to collaborate with Brian. We've done it a lot, and looking forward to a lot more. Speaking to things like the telecom, I will be at a show called Enterprise Connect in a month or so. Padre will be there as well. And I plan to spend a lot of time trying to line up people, get them into Brian's queue to consider for guests. So with any luck at all, we'll be able to bring on some more of the corporate communications, the telecom, the what used to be VoIP, but is now simply enterprise communications folks. As for me, I'm writing, and I think in about 10 days there will be some news from me. So in a couple of shows, I'll have some big news about what's going on next. But if you want to keep up with me, the way to do it is to follow me on Twitter, KG4GWA. That's where I tend to do a lot of my notification about where I'm writing. To be honest, I've been a little bit low on writing lately. You might can tell from the lack of stuff on the shelves in the process of getting ready to move the Swamp Studio. And, with any luck, I have some news on that in the next couple of weeks as well. So it's a busy time down here in the Swamp. But always, always make time to be with you here on TWiET. Well, speaking of TWiET, you can follow us here, watch the show live at twit.tv/TWiET and join the chat room at http://irc.twit.tv. And if you want to keep up with what is going on, well, with this show and a lot of others, be sure to follow Padre on Twitter at PadreSJ. For all of us here, this is TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech. And when it comes to keeping up with what's happening in enterprise tech, well, just keep TWiET.